Mrs. Humphrey and I mourn the loss of a very dear friend, just as the nation mourns the loss of a remarkable man and a leader who struggled to bring dignity and hope to all of the American people. Lyndon Johnson's public life, as we know, was filled with controversy. I believe so above all because he was a man who acted and cared, and he was a man of decision. He will be remembered most kindly by those whom society had forgotten or ignored. He was a strong man who cared for the weak and for the sick. He was a school teacher who dedicated his public career to the cause of education for every American. He was a man of compassion for the elderly and of concern for the young. I believe that no man gave more to the struggle for human rights nor asked more of us in the battle against racism and discrimination than President Johnson. And he was a president who saw America as a guardian of freedom, and he acted accordingly. Above all, Lyndon Johnson believed in this country. He believed that our country could build a society of opportunity and of justice for all. He drew strength, understanding, and purpose from his dear wife, Lady Bird Johnson, and his devoted family. And to them, we convey our sympathy, and with them, we share a great loss.
Senator Humphrey, you know, there were lots of people who thought that the President Johnson was sort of corny, being from Texas there, had the accent and all. What was your view of him as a man?
He was a man, that's first of all. When he was himself, the physical man, the active man, the talented, the political man, he was a very attractive man. Above all, I think that, that the attempt to portray him, as you've indicated, was really self-defeating because most people knew that this man had great ability. And some of the actions that he took actually brought him closer to the people. I don't believe that many people like those who try to be too overly sophisticated. They prefer to have their leaders understand them.
He was not sophisticated. He was earthy and right down to the people. Wasn't
he was a virtuoso in many ways. He could be sophisticated, and some of his messages were erudite, sophisticated, and truly intellectual gems. But basically, he was a legislator. He was a leader. He was an earthy man. He was a student of American politics, and above all, a student of people. I think this was his great success as a legislative leader. He knew everything about everybody in the Congress, and he knew their prejudices, their hopes, their fears, and their aspirations. And he never permitted himself to be locked up into a pocket, so to speak. He wasn't tagged liberal or conservative. He refused to be Southern or Northern. He said, I'm an American. And some people used to think that was a bit corny. But I remind you that he had the friendship of a man like Wade Morris, and at the same time, the devoted friendship and respect of Harry Byrd. He had the abiding friendship and respect and affection of Herbert Lehman, New York, a truly great person for the Senate. And yet, at the same time, he was a devoted friend and had the deep friendship of Richard Russell. He had a wide spectrum of interests and friends, and I think that's what it takes to be a president in America, because this country is made up of many peoples and many cultures, many ideas, many regions. And I always thought that President Johnson came pretty close to representing the rugged, the dynamic, at times unsophisticated, and even at times rough and tough spirit of this country.
Well, now, speaking of roughness and toughness, on occasion he had, gone into towering rages, and perhaps you were present at one time or so when he did that?
Well, any man that tells you that he has perfect self-control, he's a man that's spending so much time on himself, he doesn't have time for others. He was a sentimentalist, a man of emotion, but also a man of understanding and experience. I not only know that at times he can get a bit angry, he's he's on occasion, was on occasion a bit angry with me.
Did he ever chew you out?
The next day, he put his arms around you. I always felt that my relationship with President Johnson, when I was vice president, was like a marriage. At times it was a bit stormy, but it lasted. And we got along well, but we were individualists. He was the president, and there was no mistaking that. And I knew it. And as vice president, I was his loyal partner. And to me, that was my responsibility. Any differences we ever had, they were very modest and few. Those were done, held in private. I tried to do my job as a member of the team. I think he respected me for it.
Senator Humphrey, how do you think he got trapped in that quagmire of Vietnam?
Well, this is a question that you could have asked Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson. I suppose that all of them and all of us, including myself, were of that young generation that had the experience of World War II and the post-war period, the period of the Cold War. And what was happening in Vietnam seemed so much like what happened elsewhere that our response to it was a sort of a Western response to a set of circumstances in a different culture, in a different part of the world. I've always said that we made decisions about Vietnam knowing so little about the Vietnamese, knowing so little about their culture, about their politics, about their religion, the things that move people, that cause societies to be what they are. We're essentially a Western nation oriented towards Europe, and our experience is all there. The only knowledge we had in the Far East was out of the tragedy of the struggle of World War II. And that was a knowledge out of war, not out of peace and understanding. I guess the best way to put it is we were a world power, knew it, had world responsibilities, and we have had world responsibilities, that we had a half-world knowledge.
After he left office, and I know you saw him from time to time, President Johnson ever expressed regrets about Vietnam, that he had not pursued a different course, for instance?
No, not that I knew of. But I know one thing about President Johnson, that he sought relentlessly for peace. And I know, because I said to my wife tonight as we were sitting there really shocked by the news of his death, that I recall on the day of March 31st, morning of March 31st, Sunday, 1968, when he came to my home and sat there and talked to me and said that he was not going to run for re-election. And he said the reason, Hubert, is twofold. He said, if I run for re-election, everything I do to search for peace will be interpreted as political. And I want peace, and I'm going to do everything I can to get this war over. Secondly, he said something else to me, which I don't think I've ever revealed publicly. He said, you know, the men in my family do not live long. And I think I could understand very well what he was talking about. But this man wanted peace, and I think that the heartache that he had, more than anything else, was that every effort he made for it seemed not to yield results until at the very end, as you may hopefully recall, the summer of 68, he was able to get some agreement to bring the North Vietnamese to Paris. He really believed that we then were on the road to peace. And all during that summer and fall, I worked very closely with him, and I know how he was tenaciously pursuing every possibility to bring that war to an end. I think that was his heartache, that he could not find the peace. But I want to say that as he leaves us now, the peace that he sought is within our grasp now. And it's taking place in Paris. And it was Lyndon Johnson that brought the combatants, the belligerents to Paris. Let's not forget that. It was President Lyndon Johnson that brought North Vietnam, South Vietnam, National Liberation Front to Paris. He set the framework for the pursuit of peace. And peace takes time.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Yes, and then you went on
to Mexico. Waiting to talk with you here, and I'd like to hold up for about 10 minutes while you get a couple of radio.
Al Isley, have
and Al Isley, we need to get to him right
away. You better call him.
Oh, you might pick it up on the table.
What?
Put it on.
Call him.
Yeah, sure, it won't hurt me at all.
Okay.
Can I sign anymore?
Sure.
Hello? Yes. Yes, Steve. Well, I'm sitting here at the desk and I'm pleased to visit with you, even though it's not the happiest occasion. Yes, I surely do. When we first came into the Senate in 1949. Well, I knew that he was important because he seemed to know the important people in the Senate. And I was a newcomer from the Midwest with no real acquaintanceship in the United States Senate. And the word had sort of spread that people like Thurman Arnold, a very famous lawyer and jurist here in the city, knew him. And that men like Clark Clifford knew him, and Sam Rayburn knew him. In other words, powerful personalities knew Lyndon Johnson. And so when I met him, I was aware of that. And by the way, we sort of hit it off quite well on our very first meeting. Yes. That's for sure. Yes. Well, let me just say that in his style of governing, number one, he worked with his cabinet very closely. The cabinet meetings were always a priority, and they were attended by the cabinet officer. He held everybody accountable for their area of responsibility and literally ran a checklist on you, just like a pilot checks out his plane before he takes off. My own relationships with him were both very private on the one hand, and then my public duties. Privately, Mrs. Humphrey and I often dined with the President and Mrs. Johnson. Many times at night he would call me very late and he'd say, "I can't sleep, Hubert, come on over, I want to talk to you." And that happened many, many times. And sometimes I'd get a call at 6:30 in the morning. He'd say, "What's the matter with you? I thought you were a country boy. How come you're not up?" He said, "You better get on over here. We're going to have breakfast." And he always was with a jocular vein on things like that. And yet he had responsibilities that he expected you to assume. As vice president, you were to be second, not first. He was a man that knew his position and wanted you to remember yours. Yes, I surely do. You know, one thing that was always interesting to me was that as president, he was constantly inviting into the White House old friends of his from Texas, school teachers and school chums and some old family doctor or a neighbor or a cousin. This man, despite all the public description of him, was a very sentimental man. And I remember that he invited over to one time to Washington somebody that he stayed with in Australia when he was in the Navy. And these people always were given special attention. The people that worked for him, that were his, that you might say the people that were in his employees at his home or at his ranch, they'd be brought up to the White House. He made the White House, its state functions, its social functions, I think much more of a democratic institution than most presidents do. I guess I shouldn't say most because I haven't known most, but I've known several. He was, and he had an uncanny sense of knowing people, what they have done, what they wanted, and what their background was. That was his genius as a legislative leader, and he never permitted himself to get pocketed in any sort of a comfortable little niche where you could just tag him, put a tag on and say that well, he was Southern, or he was liberal, or he was conservative, or he was this or that. For example, he refused to sign the Southern Manifesto, which many people now have forgotten, but I thought that was rather significant. That's when Southern states were rebelling against the decision of the Supreme Court. And yet, as one of his closest and most intimate friends was a very famous and beloved Senator Richard Russell of Georgia. Yet at the same token, a man like Wayne Morris was his friend. I can remember when the presidency, when Wayne Morris would denounce President Johnson on the floor of the Senate, and the same day the president would invite him over to the White House and say, "Wayne, you're the only man that can put through that education bill over there, and dear friend, I want you to get it done." And Wayne and the president would walk arm in arm as if they'd never had one word of misunderstanding. And this would be after Wayne Morris had literally almost demanded impeachment, only to find out that within the hour the president had called him on over and said, "Well, now we disagree on the war, Wayne, but we both agree on higher education or elementary education, and you're my leader." You just had to know this man. He wasn't, you couldn't put him in any mold. Well, I think you have to understand that like most men of sentiment and emotion and passion, and he had all of that, he could have some, he had a temper, but he wasn't a hater. It just didn't hang on. I mean, he might blow off, so to speak, on a subject or on a person, and very shortly thereafter have that same individual in talking with him, working out misunderstandings, and treating him with the greatest of hospitality. Yes. Not no strong arm, but let me tell you that that he had a way of walking up to you, and we always used to say that you had to have good strong lapels, because he would get a hold of those lapels and he'd get right up to you and whisper in your ear loud enough to be heard in the next county as to what he had in mind. But he had almost a computerized memory. I mean, he could go from one senator to another and talk to them and never get confused, and then put it all back together when he went back to his office. Yes. Well, I know that that no man sought more diligently and perseveringly to get people to come to the peace table than Lyndon Johnson. I think tonight we ought to remember that if a truce is signed and a ceasefire is achieved in Paris, and I pray it will be and think it will be, that it was Lyndon Johnson that brought to Paris in the summer of 1968 North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the Viet Cong. And that was no small achievement at the time. I'm confident that, in fact, I know that one of the reasons he did not run for re-election was that he wanted to dedicate those last months of his administration totally, without any necessity of taking care of politics, to the cause of trying to obtain peace. And he told me that on the day that he came to my apartment and said and told me that he was not going to run for re-election. I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you that. I believe that he did what he thought was right. And I must say that that it's even now rather difficult for contemporaries to pass final judgment. I'm always reminded of how people judged Mr. Truman in 1952, 53, 54. He was not very popular. There weren't many nice editorials written about him. But by 1972, when he passed away, Harry Truman was a nation's hero. And I have a feeling that history will judge Lyndon Johnson well for no other reason than the fact that he did such amazing things in the field of human rights, leading the battle for civil rights, leading the struggle for aid to education, getting Medicare for the elderly, and doing many things which will live long after his contemporary critics have faded into dust. In New Orleans, about a little over 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago about, at the memorial service for Hale Boggs. Hale was a very dear friend of Lyndon Johnson's, as he was of mine and Mrs. Humphreys. And we stood alongside of each other there at the service. He did not. Both Muriel and I were very concerned. He looked very weary and very tired, and much more so than he had when we saw him in Austin in early December. We were in Austin, Texas with Mrs. Johnson and the President at the Civil Rights Symposium, and he looked much better then. Well, I thank you. Both Mrs. Humphrey and I are sad tonight because this man was very close to us, and his dear wife, Lady Bird, is one of our dearest friends, and we, with you and other Minnesotans, share in their grief. Thank you.
On 9480.
Hello. Yeah. I've got a brief statement. Would that be all right? Yes. Mrs. Humphrey and I mourn very much the loss of a dear friend, just as the nation mourns the loss of a most remarkable man and leader who we believe struggled to bring dignity and hope to all of the American people. Now, we all know that Lyndon Johnson's public life was filled with controversy. I think it was so because he was a man of action, a man who cared, and a man of decision. He will be remembered most kindly, not by the high and the mighty, but by those whose society had forgotten or ignored. He was a strong man who cared for the weak and for the sick. As we recall, he was once a school teacher, and he dedicated his public life to the cause of education. He was a man of compassion for the elderly and of concern for the young. And no man gave more to the struggle for human rights, nor asked more of us in the battle against racism and discrimination. He was a president who saw America as the guardian of freedom, and he acted accordingly. And above all, Lyndon Johnson believed that our country could build a society of opportunity and justice. He drew strength and understanding and purpose from his dear wife, Lady Bird, and his devoted family. And to them we convey our sympathy, and with them we share a great loss. Thank you so much. Good, how are you? Yes, sir. I'm fine. Well, my good friend, that's to put it very mildly. Both Mrs. Humphrey and I were very much shocked and deeply troubled by the bulletin tonight. We've got a brief statement here. Would you care for that? Well, let me give you the statement here, and you take down what you want, and if you have any questions, you ask me. Will you? Have you got a tape there, or are you? All right. We'll start right out now. Muriel and I mourn the loss of a dear friend, just as the nation mourns the loss of a remarkable man and leader who struggled to bring dignity and hope to all of the American people. His public life was filled with controversy. He was a man who cared and acted, and a man of decision. He will be remembered most kindly, not by the high and the mighty, but by those who society had forgotten and ignored. He was a strong man who cared for the weak and the sick. He was a school teacher who dedicated his public life to the cause of education. He was a man of compassion for the elderly and concern for the young. And no man gave more to the struggle for human rights, nor asked more of us in the battle against racism and discrimination than did Lyndon Johnson. He was a president who saw America as the guardian of freedom, and he acted accordingly. He drew strength in the red. I think that's enough that you have there. Well, I was attending a reception for Congressman Wright Patman, one of the senior members of the House, who was a devoted friend of Lyndon Johnson's, when the news bulletin came through. No, I did not know that he was. Well, I don't believe anybody phoned us here at 3 o'clock today to tell us that he was ill. You know, we didn't, as a matter of fact, I called the ranch, and I don't think that he was in any serious trouble. This was until almost at the time of his death. No, I didn't talk to him, but after his death, I talked to one of the Secret Service officers there. I don't know, my Minneapolis office, huh? Said that somebody called him at 3. Bill McGran? He didn't know what he's talking about. Yeah. Well, let me put it this way, that within this last month, we've lost two ex-presidents, Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson, within these last 2 months. I would remind my fellow Americans that 5 years after Harry Truman was out of office, that he was not a popular man. But as time went on, the nation saw his greatness. And when he passed away, even his most severe critic was heralding him, praising him. I have a feeling that contemporaries are never good judges of men who occupy a high office. It takes the cleansing of time, purification of time, to arrive at an objective judgment. And I'm quite confident that history will treat Lyndon Johnson very well. I don't believe we've been in contact with UPI here, have we?
No, we haven't.
No, I don't believe we've been. I'll be here for another hour. That's a good idea. Why don't you do that? Very good. You bet, thank you.
Al Isley, of course, we can take him before Frank Wright. He's having to leave and all transferring in.
Ben, if you call him, we can't transfer.
You've gotten that, haven't you? Yeah. I was over at the House of Representatives, the, what's the, at Wright Patman's. Yes, not the Rayburn Building. What was that building?
Longworth Building.
Longworth, yes. They were having a reception honoring Congressman Wright Patman, and he is chairman of our Joint Economic Committee, and so I went over to just pay a brief stop. I got over there about 6:30. One of the aides there came in and told me I was standing talking to Congressman Foley, Tom Foley, and to Adams, Rock Adams, and a couple of congressmen, one from South Carolina and Georgia, and I forgot the name. Some man came up to me and whispered and said, there's a bulletin that that President Johnson has died. And Congressman White of Texas, from the El Paso area, came up to me in a minute, and said, did you hear that President Johnson had died? And I said, I just heard it. He said, would you like to come into my office, and or what do you want to do? And so I said, well, I think I'd better go home and see if I can get in touch with the family. And I went home and I called to the family. Nobody, Lucy was not there. Linda was going to fly down. And I did not bother Mrs. Johnson. I just left a message because she was a very upset woman at the time. But we, Mrs. Humphrey and I, left our message of condolence and sympathy. And then I was incessantly on the phone. Well, I guess in light of all that's been happening, I said, this is just too much. I was actually just overwhelmed because within these days, we've gone to the memorial service for Hale Boggs and the death of Harry Truman. And then just this past weekend, one of my dearest friends and strongest supporters, Gene Wyman, out in Los Angeles, who was a tremendous help to me and to the Democratic Party, and Nick Bekich, who was a very close friend of mine. And it just seemed like it was one thing after another, along with Milt Kaplan. I don't know if you knew Milt Kaplan. Well, he was with the UPI and then the Hearst papers, and used to be out in the Minneapolis papers. Well, Milt and his wife, Doris, are very good friends, and he had just dropped off just like that. And it just couldn't be true. But yet I'd known that the President Johnson was not feeling well. And I saw him in New Orleans at the memorial service there on, I believe, the 10th of January for Hale Boggs. Lady Bird and the President were there, and Muriel and I had a visit with them there. And he looked very tired at that time, very tired. Much more so than he had when we saw him in December at Austin. He was most friendly and affectionate. The President had moods. And I just said to somebody I remember so vividly when we were walking into the service. He sat right in front of us in the cathedral. And as we were walking on in, he put his arm around me and gave you one of those special extra hugs that he would on when he was feeling sentimental and affectionate. And both he put one arm around Muriel and one around me. And we visited, particularly at that time, about Hale. Hale Boggs had been very close to, very friendly to President Johnson. And we just visited, I remember he said, it's a shame to lose a man like Hale. And we said goodbye to him that afternoon because we were outside in front of the cathedral when the military, the Navy, was giving the final salute to Congressman Boggs. And since then, we received, during Christmas, we received a very lovely present from them. And we'd had a letter from both the President and Mrs. Johnson, just a friendly little Christmas note. I think the one thing that would be maybe closest is when I when he called me to the White House from Atlantic City, and we sat there in the side office, in his office there, and he discussed with me the vice presidency and said that he asked me, "Do you want to be vice president? Do you know what it means?" And we talked about it, and he said, "I'm going to ask the convention to nominate you." Obviously, I thought that was the most precious moment, at least up to that time, that we'd had. And there were many other times that that were very meaningful to me. I can remember when we returned from one of our visits overseas, that he gave us a marvelous reception at the White House with full honors. The first dinner that he gave to Mrs. Humphrey and myself, inviting all of our children to the White House when I was vice president. In the Senate, we had many times together because I was one of his lieutenants in those days. He recommended me, as you may recall, for Majority Whip. There were many very friendly and significant relationships between us. To be close to President Johnson was not to live on a tranquil sea. Sometimes you were storm-tossed, but you generally got safely into port. Thank you. Very good. Give that thanks.
Question before Frank Wright comes in. The Today Show would work it out for 8:30 in the morning with you alone. Molly tells me.
Not so much, just kind of, you know, there's so much of this going on. It comes in waves, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
It's like airplane crashes.
Yeah.
Isn't it? You know, first there was this baggage and the... I'm just sitting here tonight. It's interesting. Before I left to go over to the Wright Patton's reception, I was reading the Nick's stuff here.
Oh, from the
Anchorage,
Alaska papers.
Yeah, Nick's baggage tribute. And it's almost.
Is that before you'd heard about it?
Yes, before I'd heard about it. And
they had another one in what was it? Nigeria, I guess. 192 people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another big plane crash.
That's supposed to be the one in
Moscow, yeah, it was bigger than the one there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was a funny thing. I was sitting here sorting out some papers from having gone to Hale Boggs' memorial. And I got that put away. I had talked to Max Campbellman on the phone and said, "Max, would you try to help pull together for me the eulogies on Gene Wyman? My old friend Gene Wyman."
Yeah. God, I read and heard about that.
Just dropped dead.
Yeah.
And, I said, I want to say something in the Senate about him because he was heading up our big Democratic dinner, you know, that was coming up, the big one for the Congress. We have a big Democratic congressional dinner.
Oh, and coming up now?
Well, yeah, it was going to be in May.
Oh.
And Gene was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
See, he had helped us in the senatorial campaign out there. You remember we went out there to his home in October?
Yeah.
He raised $350,000 for the Senate Democratic campaign single-handedly.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Gene has been my supporter for years, you know, just devoted. And he had taken on the responsibility from Fritz Hollings and Norty Hoffman and the rest of us that had gotten in touch with him and said, "Gene, we want you to head up this big Democratic dinner." and...
This was a national thing?
National one, going to be here in Washington. Big one. We're going to raise a lot.
The annual spring.
Yeah, the annual spring congressional dinner. And, of course, Bangle, he dies. And so I was talking to Max, and just a night before this business, and I said, Max, could you pull together the tributes that were given to Gene? And I want to say something in the Senate, and I know that John Tunney wants to say something, and Alan Cranston, and I think that Mike Mansfield and Fritz Hollins and myself and some of us that worked with him all want to say a little something, and then we can put it together in a little booklet and have it for his family. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, I'm reading Bench, his papers. And number three, I'm putting together the papers on
Boggs.
Mm-hmm. I get in the car and go on over to Wright Patnam's reception. Wright is the chairman of our Joint Economic Committee, mm-hmm. new chair, the chairman now since Proxmire. Every other year, you know, every other Congress, they change. I didn't get over there till about 6:30. The party was to break up around 7 o'clock. I don't care to spend too much time there. So I went on over there, and I...
Where was it?
At the Longworth Building, mm-hmm. and on the first floor there. And I walked through and said hello to Wright and his wife, and talked to a number of the congressmen over there. Tip O'Neill was there, and Doc Morgan, and Brock Adams and Tom Foley. Well, to make a long story short, I'm standing, I'm just getting ready to leave, about 7 o'clock, I guess. And I'm walking my way towards the door, and I'm talking to Brock Adams and Tom Foley and Congressman White in the El Paso area out in Texas, and one of the congressmen from Georgia and South Carolina, William Jennings, Brian, forgot now that they were just sitting there, just talking there. And fellow came up and whispered in my ear. I don't know who he was. I know him, but I couldn't remember my name. He said, Senator, did you hear that there's a bulletin? Just came through that President Johnson has died. And I said, you sure? Well, he said, I don't know. He said, I just heard it. And I said, well, let's see here. So I said to John White, Congressman White, I said, did you hear? He said, yeah, I just heard it. He said, maybe we ought to walk in the office and double check it. So we did. And he said, do you want to stay here? Because you're getting a lot of telephone calls. I said, no, I better. First, I said, I want to go home. Because I said, if Muriel hears this, she's going to be really upset because she went out to Gene Wyman's funeral and just gotten back. And I went home. And when I walked in the door, while Muriel was in tears, she said, it's just more than I can take, Daddy. She said, she said it just seems like it's just been one friend after another. We went down to Hale Boggs's, and out to Gene Wyman's, and out to President Truman's. And there was Nick Begich and his wife. Nick was a very close personal friend. And then Milt Kaplan. You knew Milt, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, Milt and Doris were close friends of mine, you know.
He died too?
No, just dropped dead.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, just like that. 47 years, 50 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
Just boom.
Just lately?
Yeah, just last week.
Oh, geez, I didn't know.
And then who was it? It's somebody else that was one of our friends. Well, I mean, it's just gotten, you know, it finally gets a hold of you. I mean,
yeah.
And I've known that President Johnson was not well. And I saw him as I think I indicated. Did I indicate to you? I've talked to so many people here. The last time I saw the president was at his personally saw him, was at the New Orleans services at the cathedral.
Boggs.
For Boggs. Mm-hmm. I did see the president on the television at a football game, somewhere along the line back here. But when we saw him there with he and Lady Bird, he looked terribly tired.
Oh, really?
He looked very tired, much more so than when we had seen him in December at Austin. While he looked a little tired in Austin,
was that for that
Civil Rights Symposium? He seemed to get better as the day went on. As I've said, there's nothing like praise to make you feel better. And he was being praised, rightly so, by a large number of leaders in the civil rights field. But on that day, Frank, we were in New Orleans. We were, Johnson sat right in front of us in the church. We were in fact, the first row was President Johnson, Mrs. Johnson, and Lucy, and her husband, Linda and her husband. And then right behind them was, and with the governor, sitting here with Governor Edwards, and with Senator Long. And right behind them was myself, and some of the members of the House, Tip O'Neill, others, Carl Albert. We sat right behind the president, President Johnson, then. Well, on the way coming in, when we arrived just before the services, there was a kind of a reception room. And I don't know if this will mean much to you, but President Johnson, if you knew him, you knew that he was a sentimental fellow. Sometimes he was like a warm, friendly, big bear, you know? I mean, just a warm, friendly man. He was a very sentimental man. And on this day, when Muriel and I came in, he walked in between us, and he put his big arms around us, right around our waist, and drew him, and said, "How, you know," he said, "it's good to see both you, Hubert and Muriel." He said, "I'm so glad to see you. He said, "Ken, when are you going to come down to the ranch? When are you going to come down and see us?" And then Lady Bird was there. Well, I know the president because I've been with him so much, and I've seen him in times when he'd be preoccupied with something where he'd hardly even recognize, you know, he'd recognize you, but it was perfunctory.
Mm-hmm.
And then the very next day, it might very well be that he's just full of you, you know, just wanting to be so friendly. And this time, the last two or three times that we've seen him, he seemed, you know, like each time was the most precious time.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost kind of an adieu, you know?
Yeah. Like he knew the time was...
Yeah, and Lady Bird had told me that he had not been well,
mm-hmm.
that it had been more difficult for him. He had these pains, angina, and that in the afternoon he'd suffer a good deal of pain.
Mm-hmm.
When he told me in March 31st, 1968, that
he was
not going to run, mm-hmm. there were two reasons that he assigned for this. He came over to my apartment. I was to go to New Mexico. I was to go to Mexico City. I was being sent there to sign the treaty for keeping the Latin America a nuclear-free zone. Mm-hmm. This had been something I'd worked on as a senator and advocated. So he was kind enough to say, "Hubert, you go down and take that over and go through all of the formalities and you sign for the government of the United States and take care of that." Well, that had been arranged perhaps to be done on the 1st of April 1. So on the 31st, we were to leave to fly to Mexico City that afternoon. In the morning, we're all ready to go. We're supposed to go at the airport in Andrews Field. We're supposed to be there by 1 o'clock. And at 12 o'clock, in comes the president, at 12:10, just as we're leaving, mm-hmm. just leaving. And he had been to church, and he come and rapped on the door without any forewarning or anything else, just came on up. Come on in, he said, "Well, you know how he talks, what are you going to do? Where are you taking off? You're running out of town?" And I said, "You may be forgotten, Mr. President, but you gave me a little assignment." "Oh," he said, "you and Lady Bird, you always like to travel. You find any excuse to get out of town." He said, "Whenever I want Lady Bird, I look around," he said, "you never can find her. She'll be either out with Lawrence Rockefeller or Hubert Humphrey. That's just, all you got to do is find Hubert Humphrey or Lawrence Rockefeller and you'll find Lady Bird." Right? You know how he just talked like that. He's just going on and on and on, teasing her. And I said, "Well, you not let Lady Bird go with us. We're going to Mexico City." "Yes," he said, "but don't mention her. She'll go along." You know how he just...
Yeah.
And he said, then he said to me, "Could I talk to you alone?" Well, I said, "Of course, Mr. President." So we went. The ladies excused themselves and went on into a little room where our fireplace is up there. We sat out there, and tonight Muriel and I were sitting at the same place. We were just thinking. And you've been up to our home, I think.
Yeah.
One balcony there in the center where there's a couple of sofas, one on each side. And he said to me, told me what he said, "I want to tell you what I have in mind." He said, "I'm not going to run for re-election." I said, "Oh, now, Mr. President, don't talk like that. You know that you're going to run, and you owe it to me and to the country, and you owe it to the party. You just got to run." He said, "No. And he went all through this. He said, you know, I almost didn't run in 1964. He said, I really shouldn't have run in 1964. Lady Bird didn't want me to run. And he said, I got our communications got mixed up. He said, and I got Lady Bird's note, I may not run. But he said, I'm not going to run. And he said, I'm going to tell you why. He said, I got a chance maybe to get this war if I don't run. But he said, whatever I do, from here on out, up to election time, will be interpreted politically. No matter what moves I make, it'll be interpreted as if it is a political maneuver on my part for my re-election. I said, Hubert, I want to get this war over. I want to get peace so much, he said, I can hardly bear to think about it. And he said, if I do not run, I can put my full time on a nonpartisan basis to getting this war over. And nobody can suspicion me. He said, I will not have any. He said, they can't say that Johnson is trying to wheel and deal and Johnson's doing this and that because he didn't get reelected. And he said, I think I can maybe get the peace conference started and I think I've got a chance. But I can only do it if I, if I don't run. And he said, I want peace. And he said, I'm going to get it. And he said, the second thing that you heard, he said, if I were to run, he said, it's a terrible physical strain. And he said, you know, I've had my problem. And he said, the other thing is that men in my family don't live long. And then he started reciting the different men in his family that had died in their early 60s. And he said, I just think the strain of the campaign, and if I were elected, the strain of the office would be too much. And he said, it wouldn't be fair to the people. He said, now I want you to keep your mouth shut about this, because he said, I've got to really finalize what I'm telling you between now and 8:30 tonight. I want you to tell a living woman. And he said, it's 99 chances out of 100 what I've told you is what I'm going to do. And he said, I'll let you know in Mexico City. And he said, I want to show you my speech. So he gave me a speech. He said, I got two endings to it. One ending didn't say anything about the elections at all. He just simply said the course that he was going to pursue on the peace front. Mm-hmm. And the other one was the ending that I hereby announce, and I'm not going to be. He said, I'll call you, or I have Marvin call you. And he said, if it's number two, it's the one that he will just simply say that he's going to give the second speech. Mean that I'm not going to run, because he says, I don't want you to be down there and have this announcement come without you knowing it. And so on the way going out of the door, when he left, he picked Muriel up literally and put his arms around and gave her a big kiss. Mm-hmm. And when we went to the airport, he always liked Muriel very much, she liked him. They were real good friends. And on the way to the airport, Muriel said to me, what's wrong with the president? First, she says, what did he talk to you about? What was he talking about? I said, you were in there talking so long. She says, you know, we're terribly late getting off. And I said, well, you know, you don't tell the president, you know, I'm in a hurry, I gotta catch an airplane. I mean, after all, I'm going because he sent me. But he said, well, what was so important? I said, honey, I'm not gonna talk about that. You know, we have ground rules here, you know, we don't. Because you generally don't even ask me a question like that. I said, if there's anything I want to tell you, I'll tell you. But she said, there's something wrong with him. Isn't he feeling well? Has he got some therapist or something special that's come up? I said, why? Why do you ask? She said, well, the way he put his arms around me and just sort of hugged me. He said, you know, I said, I know him pretty well. He said, he's got something on his mind that's different than ordinary. Just that woman's intuition, just like that. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, oh, yes. Yeah. You know, I said, the trouble with you women is you think that every time the president like gives you a hug, by God, he's in love with you. I mean, you're just vain. So when we got down there, and I got that telephone call at about 20 minutes after 8, he was going on the radio or TV at 8:30. I then told the ambassador that I wanted the ambassador
call in the president of Mexico. By the way, the president of Mexico had never been to the American embassy, nor had any president of Mexico ever been to the American embassy since the revolution in 1910. The first time Diaz Ordaz was the first president ever came, because the American embassy is American soil in Mexico. And their proud nationalism, they just never went to the American embassy. But he happened to come that night to that dinner, so he and his wife, the president of Mexico and his wife, Muriel and myself, the Ambassador Freeman and his wife, and about two or three others were in there, and I announced, I said, "You've got to listen. I'm sorry to interrupt our proceedings here, Mr. Ambassador, and I'm not at liberty to tell you why, except that it is important that we be in your study and that you tune in the radio to the president, because he's going to make a very important announcement. And I have got to insist that whatever your plans are for the dinner," because he called for us to be seated.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "We cannot do it." And he said, "Well, that's a rather unusual request, but you're the vice president, I guess." And he said, then he got to go to the side. He said, "What about the president here, president of Mexico?" He said, "That's most unusual." I said, "He'll understand." I said, "Believe me, just follow me." So we sat and listened, and when it came down, Muriel just kind of broke down and said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" You know, that was in the paper. You know, when, mm-hmm. when she came out, she was so upset. So that's the last. That was the background of that mm-hmm. particular episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got other things to do. I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Called. He's president of the United States, 1964, February.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, Hubert," he said, "I've had a talk with Mike Mansfield. I've told Mike that I want you to be the floor leader for the Civil Rights Bill. This has been your life in the Senate, and I want you to handle it." I said, "I also told him that you won't win." He said, "It won't be because you don't want to win." But he said, "You liberals will never stick together long enough to ever beat Dick Russell." He said, "You'll all be off running off making some speeches. And Dick Russell knows the rules. Your people don't, and they won't abide by them if they do. And but he said, "It's going to be your test." And he said, I'm just going to lay it on the line to you. He said, "This will be your real test as a legislative leader." But he said, "I'm going to predict right now you won't make it." Well, he knew me. He knew, see, that he was gouging me into action, yeah. See. And you know, and then he said, "Of course," he said, "I know that you'll give it everything," but he said, "You'll never be able to hold that gang together." He said, "They'll all be off running off chasing rabbits when they're supposed to be there." So we settled in, and I organized that Senate for that civil rights fight like nobody's ever organized it. We had daily bulletins, we had captains, we had people that were responsible for quorums. We divided up the Senate into groups, and we only once failed to get a quorum,
mm-hmm.
and we beat them. On their own game. That was the number.
With the help of Ev Dirksen.
Well, yes, but we took a little help. It took a little time to get Ev Dirksen around.
Yeah.
And the next time, as I said, the most impressive time is when most exciting time, yet also the most frustrating time was during the summer and spring of '64 when he was playing that game of who will be vice president. But I think that of all the liberals in Congress, that I always had the best relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
We got along well. And we hit it off, about as good as you could with Johnson.
Yeah.
What's up, Betty?
We're gonna have to conclude very soon. How are you coming, Frank?
I'm fine.
Fine. What are we doing now?
He won't quit talking.
Well,
I want Frank to have it good. I mean, after all, I don't know why I should give some New York paper something that I'm not going to give Frank.
That's true.
I got orders around here that we want to cooperate with our Minnesota press.
Exactly right.
We were there before you were, and we'll be there after.
Well, I don't know. I plan on living a long time.
You better continue to get along with it.
Yes, I tell you, it's not always easy.
Well, thanks again.
Thanks, you bet.
You did get what you needed on it. Well,
thanks, Wayne.
We'll see you.
You bet.
Okay.
So long now.
Yep, take it easy.
You bet. Are you playing hockey now?
Yeah. There's a men's league. It's like a metro league.
Uh-huh. Go to it. Is the old man any good? Can he skate?
I grew up in Illinois.
He's a manager. He's the manager type, huh? That's good. So long. Who you got?
APB reporter waiting outside. We've got KSTP in Minnesota. We've got about this Texas radio stations. We've got another about 10 calls besides the AP reporter. And how are you feeling?
AP.
AP.
Yeah, get him first.
Okay, he's in the office.
Well, what about KSTP? We got
and call. KSTP. I wonder if we should get them before you see the AP
reporter. Yeah, put KSTP in on the Watts line right now.
Senator, before we put them on, the CBS or
the CBS morning show. They would, I think we ought to just plan to cancel that definitely. So I will cancel out the morning show since you did what you did with Connie Chung tonight. You haven't done anything with NBC at all. So your Today Show thing tomorrow at 8:30 with NBC.
Yes, and if they want anything, they can do it later on in the day.
At KSTP, then they'll do the AP reporter.
All right.
You got KSTP
there?
Could we get you a Coke or something? But that's
Yeah, I had something.